What's a bigger subject than Stalin? Tell me what's bigger than him. Here's a guy who comes from the periphery of the Russian Empire. Mother is a washerwoman. Father is a shoemaker. Rises up to become the dictator of a sixth of the earth. And he's got the most powerful dictatorship in recorded history.
Speaking of Russia, and we have been, about Putin, the Ukraine at risk, a new Cold War, this is Stephen Kotkin of Princeton on his big new biography of Joseph Stalin.
Who killed more than Stalin? Only Mao. But did Mao defeat the Nazi land army in a war? Did Mao create a superpower the way Stalin did? So you have the biggest imaginable subject.
I'm Christopher Lydon for Open Source. We're tracing Stalin's effects to this day, forward to Putin and backward to Russian exceptionalism, something like ours, in the 19th century, and the patriotic spirit of the great Dostoevsky, novelist of the Russian soul. Is your Stalin, the young Stalin, a monster?
This is the thing about demons and monsters and horrible people and evil. The more you humanize them, the more you get to see what they were really like, the more you get to see what they think, the more you get to feel like you know them, the more you humanize them, the more monstrous they actually become. It's very easy to caricature evil. It's very easy to paint evil in a way that is, let's say, cartoonish. And we all get that. And that is a simplistic and sometimes effective way to convey the evil of these people. But when you dig deep, you get to the layers, you're looking for the person, you're trying to see the skill, how he built that dictatorship, how the others looked at him especially, and why he had authority among those close around him. You get to see all of that, and the evil actually becomes deeper.
It's one of those weird things about Vladimir Putin that he... people who like him are remembering or trying to recall what they liked about Stalin.
You're right. Putin is not a figure on the scale of Stalin, nor will he ever be. He has neither the personal characteristics nor the larger circumstances. Stalin had an idea, the idea of a new world, paradise on earth, communism. Putin has nothing like that. Stalin had, in addition, the fact that the rest of the world was full of dictatorships and authoritarian regimes. Putin lives in a world dominated by U.S. power, and U.S. power is, of course, a democracy. Germany is no longer a dictatorship. Japan is no longer a dictatorship. So Putin's ability to be like a Stalin is just not there, whatever his wishes are. But nonetheless, Stalin presided over a supreme power, and Putin is, as far as we can tell, patriotic and dedicated to the resurrection of Russian power in the world under the constraints that he's operating. So, of course, not Putin alone, but Putin included, look to the greatness in the past. Primarily, they look to the Tsarist era, when the palaces were built, when they had a big court society, right? When Russia was also a great power, but they fold Stalin in because of the World War II victory. What they're doing under Putin today is separating World War II from the communist regime and making it more a glorifying Russian national story.
I was going to say, what is the idea of Russia that Putin is drawing on that somehow connects him to Stalin?
So the Soviet Union was a deeply multi-ethnic state. Many nationalities. The Russians, the ethnic Russians, were only about 50% of the population of the Soviet Union, more or less, right? That's true also for the Tsarist Empire. And so the Soviet Union is this contraption in which Russian nationalism is present but contained by a larger structure. Stalin promoted Russian nationalism, but never for itself, never on its own terms, always as part of the communist project and as part of the multinational Soviet Union and the global communist movement. But Putin lives in a different state. Today's Russia is more than 80% ethnic Russian. It's a very much more Russian nationalist state in composition. It's not the Soviet Union. The pieces that fell off. And so Russian nationalism is no longer contained inside a multinational state. It's no longer contained inside a global transnational communist movement. And instead, we're seeing Russian nationalism come to the fore. Not solely under Putin. We saw some of this before Putin came to power. But certainly Putin himself is encouraging this tremendously. And so the Stalin that he wants, and the Stalin that you see often in the proliferation of new books about Stalin in the Russian language, is this Russian national figure, born in Georgia, but nonetheless defender of Russian power in the world. And therefore, let's get rid of the communism. Let's forget that Stalin was a true believing communist, and let's talk about the war in national terms. They have a lot of holidays that they inherited from the Soviet period, and the one holiday that has the most meaning that they inherited from the Soviet period is the Victory Day in the war. But even November 7th, which is the anniversary of the revolution, that is to say the holiday that passed only a few days ago, even November 7th has become less and less a communist holiday, the anniversary of the revolution, of the Bolshevik Revolution, and more a national story. I expect that this is going to continue. But this is what you need to know about this kind of stuff. People talk about the Versailles Treaty and how the Versailles Treaty in 1919, after World War I, was a mistake. It was too harsh. And the British and the French shrank from enforcing it. And so therefore, the Versailles Treaty was a blunder. It was a blunder, a miscalculation, and a lack of will. And then you had the rise of Hitler, and then you had World War II, and everything else, which is often blamed on the Versailles Treaty.
Not to mention the Bolsheviks.
Correct. However, the Versailles Treaty was an anomalous moment in history. It was a time when both German power and Russian power were flat on their backs. You could never impose an enduring treaty on top of both German power and Russian power. At least one, maybe both, were going to rise again. And so it wasn't a lack of will. If the British and the French had had greater willpower, they still couldn't have enforced the Versailles Treaty because German power and Russian power, at least one, was coming back. Now look at 1991 and the post-1991 period, right? Communism collapses in 1991 and the Soviet Union dissolves. Russia is flat on its back. In fact, the collapse doesn't end in 1991. The collapse continues all through the 1990s. They go through a Great Depression. The Soviet collapse is not over as far as people experiencing it, even though the Soviet Union is gone. Russia is flat on its back. Whatever settlement is imposed on Russia in the 90s, is imposed when Russia is weak. Russia is not going to be weak forever. It's going to come back. And maybe it's not going to like the Cold War, the post-Cold War settlement. Maybe it's going to look at the post-Cold War settlement and say, this is unfair. This is something that we were forced to agree to only because we were weak. You took advantage of our weakness. This is the core of the Putin regime, the core of the Putin ideology. It's not that they expanded NATO into the Baltic region and this threatens Russia somehow because Estonia or Latvia or Lithuania are part of NATO. It's not quite that. It's that the perception that the United States and the West took advantage of Russia when it was weak and did what it wanted and imposed this settlement, which the Russians see as unfair. And so Putin looks at this and he says, I'm going to revise this settlement. I'm not going to accept these terms. And so Crimea, we saw that episode, but that wasn't the beginning. There was a war with Georgia, Abkhazia, and Ossetia. There was, going back to 1992, a piece of Moldova, which is called Transnistria, that the Russians also made into an unrecognized statelet that they broke off. And so we see them revising this post-Cold War settlement the same way that Stalin and Hitler revised the Versailles Treaty.
So where's Ukraine in this moment today?
So Ukraine is paradoxical because one of the things that Putin refers to all the time is Catherine the Great. Catherine the Great, her conquests on the Black Sea, the creation of this frontier called New Russia, right? We have places, for example, in the United States called New England. These were created by the British settlers, right? Reminiscent of the home, but a new frontier that they were conquering. But New England is no longer part of Britain. So New Russia under Catherine the Great, which Putin is referring to, is not the end of the story, because those Black Sea conquests under the imperial regime, under the Tsarist rulers, and that subsequent history was Stalin's history. And Stalin built a national Ukraine. He built a Ukraine that was more Ukrainian, ethnically, linguistically, especially in the cities, than had ever been Ukrainian before. And so Putin looks at this peace that was broken off in 1991 when the Soviet Union dissolved, and he feels it's unfair. But he has to deal with the Stalin legacy. One of the things I show in this book is how Stalin partly intentionally, partly unintentionally, created a very much more national Ukraine. And Putin, it's not Russia, it's Ukrainian. And he's coming up against the limits of this. So Crimea was an exception. It was a predominantly ethnic Russian territory. It had been, once upon a time, a predominantly Tatar Muslim territory prior to Catherine the Great's conquests. But it was never a predominantly ethnic Ukrainian territory. So it was easy for him to bite off Crimea. But biting off more of Ukraine is much harder. And we see maybe he would like to do that. But Stalin has created a much more ethnically Ukrainian Ukraine. For example, I'll give you one example that people need to remember. In the Hitler-Stalin Pact of 1939, the Soviet Union took forcibly eastern Poland, and they made it western Ukraine. That is to say, they took a territory from the independent state of Poland, they conquered it militarily, while Hitler went into Poland on one side, Stalin went in on the other, bit off eastern Poland, converted it into western Ukraine, that is to say, attached it to the Ukraine that had been inside the Soviet Union. Now, the city of Lviv, that's the Polish name, which the Germans know as Lemberg, and which the Russians know as Lvov, and today is independent Lviv, that is to say Lviv in independent Ukraine, that was a predominantly Polish-speaking city and a predominantly Yiddish-speaking city, not Ukrainian. The countryside was Ukrainian-speaking around this city, but it was inside Poland, and the education, the elites, the school systems were Polish language or Yiddish language. Now, under Stalin and his successors, this became a predominantly Ukrainian-speaking city by miles and miles. It's almost 100% Ukrainian-speaking city today. It's the bastion of Western Ukrainian nationalism. But it was a piece of Poland that Stalin bit off and attached to Ukraine. So this is what I mean when I say that Stalin created the national Ukraine that Putin is bumping up against. Maybe Putin would like to take it back into Russia, but it's not Russian, it's Ukrainian.
How far does he dare go in getting back Ukraine? And how desperately should we be exercised about it?
So we have to be careful about speculating, about imputing motives to Putin, about looking like we understand his strategy and what he's up to. We don't really know. So with Putin, we don't have good access to his regime. We have very few people with inside sources and inside knowledge. So we don't know what he's up to. Moreover, he's made contradictory statements when he's made public statements. He himself may not know what he's up to. Maybe he's got a grand planned, or maybe he's just improvising without knowing where he's going to end up. And so we're kind of stuck trying to figure out what it is that he wants and how we could possibly respond to this. You know, the people who are on the receiving end of this, they're the civilian population. The civilian population in the areas of eastern and southeastern Ukraine. They dislike the government in Kiev, and there's good reason to dislike the government in Kiev. It has been one of the most corrupt states anywhere in the world, let alone in Europe. They've stolen everything in sight. People say we need to help Ukraine, we need to send money there, we need to give aid, we need to give weapons. Well, you know, why not just deposit the money right in the Swiss bank accounts? Why route it through Kiev as a middleman, right? So there's good reason why the Eastern Ukrainians dislike or distrust the government in Kiev. That doesn't mean that they want to become part of Russia, however. They're kind of caught in the middle. There's no side for them. There's nobody necessarily asking them what they want and defending their interests. And there are upwards of about 7 million people in these regions of eastern Ukraine. Some maybe want to be part of Russia, but do all want to be part of Russia? Absolutely not. Most detest the government in Ukraine, but does that mean they reject any possible government in Ukraine? No, they've been living in the independent state of Ukraine, and many of them would want to stay there, provided the government in Kiev were better. So you have this very substantial population stuck in the middle, and each side is shelling them, and each side is trying to conscript them into war, and they're the civilian population caught in the middle. That's why many analysts who are not pro-Ukrainian, who are not pro-Russian, but are anti-war, have been calling for a ceasefire and a settlement. This seems to play into Putin's game. It seems to give him the advantage. Right. On the other hand, at least 4,000 people have died in this conflict. There are 800,000 displaced people. A great deal of the infrastructure is destroyed. And winter is approaching. And the winter is a serious proposition out there. So who's going to help these people? Who's thinking about the people? Not thinking about the game between Kiev and Moscow, or Moscow and Washington, or Brussels, Washington, and Moscow. That's all very important. But let's also think about the civilian people caught in the middle, right?
Yeah, please.
So it's important to know what Putin is up to. It's important to know how we could possibly respond. But it's also very important to treat this as a humanitarian issue before it becomes a catastrophe.
So how do we do that? I mean, speak to us peaceniks who don't want a war around this thing and hate the kind of rallying of Cold War feelings, or even, you know, blaming the brute Putin in certain domestic matters for his hunger for Ukraine. I mean, these seem to be sort of two separate matters. How do we sort it out?
What, so let's what should think we be about the for? Stalin regime for a second, the evil communist Stalin regime, right? George Kennan explained to us that the best policy would be containment. That is to say, patience and resolve. In other words, it is potentially too costly to take it head on and to try to roll it back. But if we block it from expanding, if we contain it, it might collapse of its own contradictions. It might self-destruct. It might become deeply unpopular. It might undermine itself through its own contradictions, misrule, incompetence, corruption. And I think we have, on a much smaller scale, there's no comparison to the Cold War. Today's Russia is not the Soviet Union. It's not a threat on that level. But nonetheless, the wisdom of Kennan can be applied here, which is to say, if we try to contain this, we may not be able to roll back the positions that have been advanced right now. But if we put a kind of fence around it and we inflict some pain through sanctions, if we get lucky and the price of oil drops even more, it's dropped more than 30% since the summer, which has a very big effect on the ability of the Russian government to meet its budgetary commitments, because oil and gas are more than 50% of the Russian budget. So if the price of oil goes down, if the financial sanctions continue to bite, and if the Putin regime continues to make mistakes, continues to have a very poor economic policy, they're entering stagflation right now, which is something we experienced here in the U.S. in the 70s. That is to say, economic contraction plus inflation, so-called stagflation, stagnant economy plus the inflation. This could potentially, over a certain period of time, undermine that regime. We don't know how long that would take. It took many decades in the Cold War. It could be quick, it could be slow, but patience and resolve. Not recognizing annexation of territory, but also not doing something that would be unsuccessful, which would be to escalate the conflict so that more people would die and we'd be unable to get our way in any case. Let's think about this for a second. Ukraine doesn't have an army. And people say, well, gee, let's supply lethal weapons to them. First of all, supply lethal weapons to whom? To whom exactly would get the weapons? The weapons that the Ukrainian army had, they sold on the black market. Not the conscript soldiers necessarily, but their officers or the defense ministry personnel, right? So to arm them, we'd have to know whom exactly we would arm. In addition, if we escalate, what's to stop the Russians from escalating? They have a real army there. Ukraine doesn't have an army. The Russians have 30,000 to 50,000 crack troops, elite troops. They have an 800,000 person army. Most of it are conscripts eating dog food and treated like that. But then they have 30,000 to 50,000 in the crack units who are very well supplied, very well trained, and as good as any soldiers on the planet. How are we going to stop a force like that unless we ourselves go into that conflict, right? So you can't arm the Ukrainian army to take care of this yourself. Plus, let's say we gave them the weapons and they went into battle, and Putin could use covert operations. They could blow up the train stations in western Ukraine through terrorist operations. They could infiltrate covert operators and have them terrorize the population far from the battlefield by blowing up some of the infrastructure. Who's going to take a train? Who's going to take a bus if some of them blow up? And Putin's regime is capable of stuff like that. So you kind of have to be careful if you think you're going to escalate the battle. What's going to be your next step if the other side responds with escalation? So here we need a negotiated settlement. We need to recognize our limitations. We need to contain, show patience and resolve, inflict some pain, economic pain, on this regime, see what we can do about alternative energy and lowering the price of oil, and use that combination of instruments to see if the regime wouldn't self-destruct on its own.
You're quoting George Kennan on containment. I'm reading George Soros in the New York Review saying, in effect, sanctions are not enough. We've got to beef up the regime in Ukraine and help them, I suppose, militarily in the end.
Everything that George Soros wrote in that New York Review of Books article is smart. He wants a real Ukrainian state. He wants a well-governed Ukraine because he thinks it's very important, not only for Ukraine, just like you're saying. But here's the issue with that, Chris. This is not the first time we've confronted this. It is now 23 years since the Soviet collapse. There have been reform programs after reform programs in Ukraine. There have been IMF programs after IMF programs. There have been democracy programs, rule of law programs. This has been tried. And moreover, it was tried not just under pro-Russian regimes in Ukraine, but under elected pro-Western regimes as well. And what was the result? The result was the elites stole all the money and no reform happened. Do you know that the Ukrainian economy today, 23 years after the collapse of the Soviet Union, is smaller than it was at the year of collapse? The Ukrainian economy has shrunk. All of Ukraine, the whole GDP of Ukraine today is $175 billion. That's it. Putin's economy is over $2 trillion. It's more than doubled in size in ruble terms, and it's grown tenfold in dollar exchange rate terms since the collapse of the Soviet Union. They had structural economic reform under the evil Putin during the first term of his presidency. Under Ukraine, they've had nothing of the sort. And so, of course, Soros is correct that the kind of programs he has mentioned ought to be implemented in Ukraine. That's the stuff they need. They need a real civil service, an impartial judiciary, professional judges, right? They need to have better regulation, fewer regulations, and smarter regulations. They need to have honest policemen. All the things he's saying, he's been saying for a long time, and he personally has put his money where his mouth is and has invested in these programs. But I've been to Ukraine many times over the years, and I watched under each regime. They have, instead of reform, feathered their own nests. And therefore, before Putin got anywhere near Ukraine, before he started to do the nasty stuff that he's done, Ukrainian elites wrecked that country. This is a really important point for us to know.
But Georgios is also saying that there's a new Ukraine, capital N, capital U, ready to take charge.
There were a lot of courageous people in the streets during that second revolution. How many people? Yanukovych, the president, was overthrown twice in his own country, in the Orange Revolution of 2004-5, and then more recently, 2013-14, right? How many people can you say that about? And there were a lot of courageous young Ukrainians and middle-aged and old Ukrainians in the streets looking for a new country. And they also voted in a recent election, both for the president and for the parliament there, right? But there has been no transformation in the behavior of the government. Moreover, a lot of areas don't even have government. A lot of people were unable to vote. And what is not mentioned in the article, the population of Ukraine participating in elections has been declining for many years. The people feel like it's not worth it anymore because they vote and the same crooks or different crooks, similar behavior, the country gets worse. Nothing good happens. There's no reform. There's no job creation. Do you know before the annexation of Crimea and before the nastiness in eastern Ukraine, where we now have these separatist enclaves, that more than 1 million Ukrainians had gone to Russia to work because it was the only place they could find jobs because the Ukrainian economy was not creating jobs, right? So we have to remember that even though Soros's proposals are smart, that it's not the first time we're trying them. Maybe it would succeed this time, but that's what people said the last time and the time before. They're now on their third IMF package in just the last 10 years. Colossal 15 billion plus IMF packages. The first two were canceled in the middle of them. Now we're on the third one. We're going to see what's going to happen with this one. So if you could tell me the mechanisms of how reforms would actually be implemented, then I would be in favor of the investment in such reforms. But there's cause for skepticism, even though you don't want to abandon hope.
Steve Kotkin, in all of these Russian stories, I'm looking for the ghost of Dostoevsky. And especially in Putin's case, this idea of Russia as the true Orthodox Christian nation. This is what Jesus had in mind, but a big nationalist sense of Russia, especially in one of the neglected novels, I think, Demons, The Possessed, which is all about this infection from Europe, and we've got to ward it off, purge the giant Russian soul of all this evil. Sometimes I look at Putin and I think he's a kind of bad cartoon or bad takeoff, caricature of what was so beautiful in Dostoevsky.
You're right, Chris. We see this again and again. We see this providential mission, specialness of Russia, exceptionalism, Eastern Orthodoxy, not really part of the West, right?
Exactly.
Its own civilization. We see this coming back again and again. There's a version of it under Stalin, as I describe in the book that I wrote. Of course, it's a communist version of a providential mission in the world. But as you can see, leading the Comintern, leading the Communist International, leading the world communist movement is a way to try to realize that Russian exceptionalism in a new form. But it doesn't work. And the reason it doesn't work, Chris, is because the West has the technology. Fortress Russia is never a successful strategy. Because if you want to get the oil out of the Arctic or out of the shale rock or out of difficult places, you need the technology that ExxonMobil and Schlumberger have. If you want to have the most advanced military to compete in the world, you need some of those avionics and electronics that the German firms can provide. So even though Russia would love to break off, be its own civilization, be its own pole in the world order, realize its supposed special providential mission in the world, it's always dependent to a certain extent on Western technologies. Stalin had this problem in spades. He found a way to do both at the same time, to push the special Russian mission in the world, Soviet civilization, while also importing the Western technology. But he had the Great Depression, which made Western firms more willing to sell stuff to the Soviet Union because there were fewer other markets that they could sell into. But that's a story that Putin doesn't have that kind of leverage, that the outside world is in depression and therefore going to Russia because they have no alternative markets. So whether Putin can find a way like Stalin did to push this Dostoevskyan line of the special providential Russia, while at the same time continuing the necessary relation with the West to be purchasing that advanced technology, that remains to be seen.
Steve Kotkin, such a pleasure. And we look forward to getting much deeper into your book on Stalin. This is the first of many conversations, I hope.
Thank you for the invitation, Chris. My pleasure.
Have a listen to our program on Russia Today and its Putin problem, which you can find on our website, radioopensource.org. And please subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. I'm Christopher Lighten. This is Open Source.